It is good to worship with you today, and it's good to be with family. Thank you. Let me mention a couple of things before I get into the book of Micah. By the way, we will be in that book. You may need a heads up so you have a little time to find that book. It's seven chapters back in the Old Testament, book of Micah. Let me mention a couple of things. One is that kindness in somebody's life is not only an act, but it has to do with the timing. A kindness done at the right time makes a great deal of difference. We want to encourage you to step in as just a part of the community, as certainly as a part of the Christian community, and be a blessing to the Joplin school system. Many of you know that they're opening three new schools when they open after the first of the year, but everything is at the old schools needing to go to the new school. And they don't have crews for that, and even if they did, they'd be paying them and everything else. The issue is there a place for the community to say, we'll help? And we want to do that. In fact, I would love for College Heights, I hope part of your tradition this year would be, we as a family help them move a school. Here's how you do that. You can go to a website. The website's pretty easy. You go on there and you click where volunteers are, joplinschools.org, and click on volunteers, and a calendar comes up, and you can click on what will work for you for your calendar. Or you can also go and phone call. Dale Peterson's in our congregation, and Dale's a key part of this. There's his work number and extension. I think he gave you his cell phone number on the second number. I wouldn't call that at 3 in the morning. A cheerful word probably wouldn't be a good thing at that time of day, or his email address, and he will help coordinate for you. They want anyone who would be helpful, but if you happen to have a school teacher's background, there's a special role for you. I mean, anybody can help. My goodness, take your kids and help on this, but if you're a school teacher, school teacher's kind of a better feel for how to set up classrooms. And if you wanted to partner with a teacher and help set up that classroom, they'd really love that. And so we want to encourage that to take place. And so I hope that'll be part of what you might do. There's a second thing I want to mention, and that is that when we begin the new year, 2014, there's a pretty specific place we need to begin, and we know we do. If you go through Scripture, anything God ever did of real significance, real movements, you're going to notice there was an incredible place for prayer. Jesus begins his ministry, 40 days of prayer and fasting off in the desert, and then his ministry begins. The crowds are gathering every morning and waiting in line, and yet Jesus is off in prayer before he goes down and meets the crowds or goes to the different towns. Jesus is going to choose the 12 to be disciples. Well, I mean, it's not hard to choose 12 guys, is it? Well, Jesus spent all night in prayer before he decided which 12 to choose, because prayer drove that. When you go to the book of Acts, you're going to see a similar kind of thing will occur. They have a 10-day prayer meeting, and the day of Pentecost occurs. When the day of Pentecost occurs and 3,000 people come to the Lord, at the end of that chapter, that very day, they're meeting in houses and they're praying together. You can see that at the end of chapter 2. When hard things begin to come and challenges, you're going to see in the fourth chapter, they meet together in houses, in the house, and they pray, and they even tell you the prayer they prayed for with boldness and those things. I mean, you just keep walking it through. When you come to the very first missionary journey, the very first time that you say, we're going to go plant churches, it comes out of a prayer meeting that occurs. We don't have any idea what God has in mind for us as a church in 2014, but here's how we probably will find out. We're going to take the first full week in January, January 5th, and as a congregation, we want to spend it in prayer. That idea of spending it in prayer will involve things that you'll do individually and at your homes and in your own life. But collectively, we're going to pray as well. And the leaders, the elders will be leading that. The first Sunday in January, January 5th, being normal Sunday as far as coming and times. But when you come that morning, it will be a morning that when you walk away, you will have said, I prayed with God's people. And the leadership led us in prayer that morning. That week, different things will occur, but on Wednesday night, and what will be that, the 8th, and Friday night, the 10th, there's going to be gatherings in here that are just where we all gathered to pray. I can tell you right now, we're not aiming for 60%. We're not aiming for 80%. What kind of a, when God's people gather together, we would hope that you would have at least one of those two nights that you would say, I will change anything I have to change to meet with my church family and spend a part of that in prayer. And so we'll give you more details, but just take the 5th through the 10th of January and realize whatever good things God does with us, whatever commitment we make to him, God, take all of us. We would like it birthed out of a time that we prayed together. And we don't know what the future holds. We have an expectation that 14 will be beyond what we could dream or imagine, that 14 could have incredible things that came and birthed out of that. So would you circle that on your calendar? Okay, did you find Micah yet? Did you find Micah? There's one word I want to drive into your thinking this morning. I'm going to just hammer on that word. It's one that helped me worship a bunch the last couple of weeks as I worked on this. And it's one that I want to be a part of your worship. I want to tell you what the word is. And then we're going to kind of come from another direction. There is a dominant word used about the coming of Christ. There's a dominant word used about Christmas, if we're going to use the birth of Christ. There's a dominant word that ought to be the center place of everything you and I understand about the coming of Christ. That word is peace. Peace. Now, why does that matter? Well, the reason it matters is because you've never lived in a world of peace. You haven't. We live in a world that's incredibly broken, and there is simply warfare at every level. Warfare outside, warfare inside, warfare at every place. We've lived here so long, we think it's normal. I used to go visit an aunt and an uncle. They lived beside a railroad tracks, and I remember just being shocked. The train would go by every 13 seconds. And when the train would go by, everything rattled in the house and everything shook. And I mean, I'm a kid and man, my eyes are popped open and I'm looking and they're just treating it like it's normal because they didn't even hear it anymore. You've grown up in that kind of a world with warfare. Warfare. New York Times says that peace is an illusion. It doesn't exist. The warfare I'm going to talk about, though, is a warfare that has us locking our doors at night. The warfare that we have has us with addictions and has us with broken marriages. It's a warfare that causes best friends to fall apart and never speak to each other again. It's a warfare that you can't even gather with some of your family because your family is estranged from each other. It's a warfare that, quite frankly, is very pervasive. Francis B. Marlon tells a story. He said it was World War I. It was 1914. It was December. And it was Christmas Eve. And the trenches where the Germans were dug in and the trenches where the French and the English were coming together. There was a time on Christmas Eve, cold, lonely, guys scared, bored, longing for better things. And a bunch of the German soldiers put candles in Christmas tree bushes and raised them up out of the trenches. Well, when they raised them up out of the trenches, the French began to sing Christmas carols back to the Germans. And the Germans sang Christmas carols back to the French. And eventually, a couple, three brave souls climbed out of their trenches that had bodies laying everywhere in the no man's land, and they walked across it. And they shook hands, and they stood there. The first few brave souls started a movement, and the next thing you knew, there was a large group that came out. When they came out, they exchanged cigarettes, and they exchanged a few little gifts back and forth, and they stood there, and they sang Christmas carols. As the Germans and French stood there, there were, again, the bodies I'd mentioned from the day's battles and 2 days before and the frozenness. And they decided to have a worship service. And they buried the dead. And they had a joint memorial service. They sang more Christmas songs. They eventually headed back to their trenches. And one person began to sing with a beautiful voice from the French side, who began to sing the song Silent Night. It's a song about heavenly peace. The Germans began to sing it in response. We look at that and there's a pull. There's a pull where we go, that's what should be on earth, a heavenly peace. The problem was it wasn't a peace that night, and you know that. It was a truce. It was a truce. Because the next morning, start all over again. They fought, they shot, they bled, they died. And the war would go on for 3 more years. you realize that's the world you grew up in. That's the world you live in. It's a world that doesn't know peace. I say all of that to bring us to this, that any time we talk about what is taking place with the celebration of the birth of Christ, the word that the Bible uses is peace. Peace. Let me take you just for a second to the war. It's pretty clear. In the book of Micah, I want you to turn there if you wouldn't mind. Here's the war. You say, who are we warring with? Well, let me tell you the first place we're warring with. Micah chapter 1. Look at verse 2. Listen, you peoples, all of you, listen, earth, and all you who live in it, that the sovereign Lord may bear witness against you, the Lord from his holy temple. Look, the Lord is coming from his dwelling place. He's coming down and treading on the heights of the earth. The mountains melt before him. The valleys split open like wax before the fire, like water rushing down from a slope. And all of this is because of Jacob's transgressions and because of the sins of the people of Israel. Hey, let's start with the first place. You know where your war first is? It's with God. The world you've been born into is at war with God. And here's a prophet of God who begins to say, you want to know what's happening in your life even right now? This war with God. You say, I don't like you saying that. Well, don't worry, the prophets of their day didn't like them saying that either, but it's still the truth. At war with God. That's the world you've been raised in. Well, why is God at war with us? Well, start reading things like chapter 2. Woe to those who plan iniquity and to those who plot evil on their beds. I mean, you lay awake in the middle of the night thinking of ways to be selfish. You lay awake in the middle of the night thinking of ways to get your way. At morning's light, they carry it out because of their power to do so. Verse 2, they covet fields and seize them and houses and they take them and they defraud people of their homes and they rob them of inheritance. Therefore, the Lord says, I am planning a disaster against this people from which you cannot save yourselves. If I took you further in this book, here's what he describes. You're in a world that is at war with God. And I grew up with that heart at war with him. Now, stick with me. I'm serious. I'm going to say something here that I need you to hang with and logically follow me here for a second. Being at war with God is an incredible paradox. Two opposite things. It is the worst, most awful thing that you can ever imagine to be at war with God. You will not win. God will never change his character. He will never change his nature. He will never change his position. He will never change his glory. He will never let the clay say to the potter, this is how it's to be done. You will never, ever win. And when God's speaking to Paul on the road to Damascus, he says, isn't it hard kicking against a sharp stick? Yeah, it is. Just keep kicking a sharp stick and see how that works for you. Warring with God is horrible and awful. And this book of Micah is going to weave through this truth. When you war with God, you will not win. Oh, you can flourish at some level, but you are failing the whole time you think you're flourishing. You're going to fail. So warring with God is awful and terrible. But here's the odd paradox. If you ever want to have an enemy, you want it to be God. If you ever have an enemy, you want it to be God. God's the best enemy you will ever, ever have. Why is that? Pretty simple. Every other enemy you'll ever have in your whole life is out for your destruction. He's the only enemy you will ever have who's out for your wholeness and your wellness. If you're going to declare a war on God, you need to know beyond the shadow of a doubt the very God you war on is wooing and pursuing you. Tim Keller, that's where I borrow some of the ideas that I'll weave in and out of this today, so I want to give him, again, credit and blame for this. But he tells a story. He said he remembers when he was a younger man, and he went by a creek or a river. And in it, he said, there was a little kitten. Apparently a group of kittens had been thrown in where somebody wanted to drown them. And as the river had carried the kitten, one of the kittens at least, down, there had been a little rock sticking out of the water, and the kitten got on top of that little rock. He said it was a scared, terrified, wet, miserable life in existence. And that kitten was hanging on for all it was worth, the little nub of a rock. He said there were guys on the gals up on the beach who wanted to go rescue that kitten. And it's very predictable. You get close and that kitten would hiss and that kitten would take its paw and it would swipe at you. And there were people who came back with bites and cuts on their hands because if you tried to get the kitten, it just tore into you. He said as we were standing there, there was one young man. And he said the young man decided any price, it was worth paying. And he went out and he reached down and he took that kitten off that. And he said he came back ripped to shreds. Kitten fighting him every step of the way. But he rescued the kitten off of the rock and put him on the dry land. His point in all that was this. We are enemies of God and have been at war with God. And we are at war with a God who's not shakable. A God who will not give in. A God whose character is absolutely certain. But a God who's willing to pay whatever is required that you might come off the little rock you're hanging on and come in. You're going to see that in Micah. Micah is full of the idea of how hard it is to war against God. But I want to take you to the fifth chapter. In the fifth chapter, here is the passage that has stood the test of time. Here it goes. It says in chapter 5, verse 2, in the middle of talking how hard it is to war for God, war against God, is there any hope? If the whole world's crazy and the whole world is living as rebels, is there any hope? Chapter 5, verse 2, but you, Bethlehem, Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will rule over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. Therefore, my people will be abandoned until the time when she who is in labor bears a son, and the rest of his brothers return and join the Israelites. And he will stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they will live securely. For then his greatness will reach to the ends of the earth, and he will be our peace. So while the war rages around you, and while everything is hopeless, turn your eyes to Bethlehem. The whole ends of the earth are going to be changed by the one who comes from Bethlehem, and he will be your peace. Whatever you think about for Christmas and the birth of Christ that you need to think peace, let me just walk you through. I'm not going to take you through all of them. There's so many of them. I'd be here forever. But the word normally associated with Jesus coming is that word peace. Let me take you to Isaiah 53. Isaiah 53 is going to make the comment about the death of Christ, but he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. That's pictures of the cross. And the punishment that brought us peace was on him. By his wounds we're healed. If I take you to the very beginning, the Gospels, when John the Baptist and his father gives a prophecy, what's the prophecy about coming of Christ? Here's the prophecy. He comes to give light to those who sit in darkness and in the shadow of death and to guide us to the path of peace. In a world that's crazy with all this broken stuff inside us and around us, this is what he comes for, to guide to the way of peace. When the angels show up with the shepherds, here's their message. Glory to God in the highest heaven and peace on earth to those with whom God's pleased. Here's what Christ comes for, is peace. And so I want to talk to you about your peace. It's what Christ came for. With Jesus' own blessing, anytime, in fact, just look consistently, a regular phrase Jesus uses whenever he has a healing. Go to the next passage. Your daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace. A regular kind of thing that was made. When he comes into Jerusalem, I think it's the next one, Luke 19. When he comes into Jerusalem, here's what Jesus says. His last pronouncement over the very city. How I wish today that all of you people would understand the way to peace, but now it's too late and peace is hidden from your eyes. The rejection of Christ, that's what you missed, is you missed peace. John 14, peace I leave with you. That's what I came. Peace I leave with you. My peace I give to you. Now, it's not that the world gives peace, do I give it to you? They only have truces. They only have a few momentary kinds of things. It's not the peace the world has. Let not your heart be troubled, neither let it be afraid. There would be people who would write a check for $1 million today. In fact, you could make a line of people who would write checks for $1 million if you could tell them there's peace once you write that check. People would give anything for peace. And here's what Jesus says. John 16, I have said these things that in me you may have peace. In the world you'll have tribulation, but take heart, I've overcome the world. John 16, keep going. The very summary in Acts 10 of the gospel is the good news of peace through Jesus Christ. Romans chapter 1, I think, is the next one. I'm writing to all you in Rome. You're loved by God. You're called to be his own holy people. May God our Father, Lord Jesus Christ, give you grace and peace. The statement about the world is this. This is about the truth about the world. And they don't know where to find peace. You come to the fifth chapter. Therefore, since we've been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God. And so we begin to find a little distinction here. I want to put this in here. Peace that Jesus brings is always associated with his name, Isaiah. He's called the Prince of Peace. There are two kinds of peace Jesus is going to bring. I want to center on the one for first. The first is a peace with God. And the second is the peace of God. They are two separate, joined together obviously, but two separate things. A peace with God, that's what comes from Bethlehem. And the peace of God. He begins to describe in this passage, Romans 15. Well, earlier he would have done it. And now may God, who gives us his peace, be with you all. Ephesians 2, for Christ himself has brought peace to us. Colossians begins to spell it out. I'll probably stop on that list here. By the way, there's 90 passages that talk about the peace of Christ in the New Testament. Or a ballpark. Colossians 1, and through him God reconciled everything to himself. He made peace in heaven and on earth, and by means of Christ's blood on the cross. This includes you, who were once far away from God. You were his enemies. You were separated from him by your evil thoughts and your actions. There was a gap. At war with God. That's where you were. Yet now he has reconciled you to himself through the death of Christ in his physical body. As a result, he has brought you into his own presence, and you are holy and blameless as you stand before him without a single fault. Craziest thing. If you are a Christ follower and a meteorite hits you today, when you stand before God, there are no set of scales weighing your good and your bad. When you stand before God, there is one who paid the price to bring you peace. He took your sin. He gave you his righteousness. And you stand there without blame in front of God. Now you tell me what in the world, if I went into my house today and looked at all the presents around a tree, or I look at anything at my house, what is the greatest single thing I have? I don't live at war with God if I have made myself to be a Christ follower. That's the first big one. That is the first huge one. This morning, I can't say this plain enough. There is nothing sweet about our traditions of Christmas, Santa Clauses and trees and angels on top of pine trees. There's nothing in gathering and having candy. There's nothing in there that is nothing more than the world's sort of attempt to have a truce. It just is. That's what it is. It's a moment. We all sort of call time out, get along best we can. If you're here this morning, and your life is not covered by the blood of Jesus Christ, Mike is still talking about you. You're at war with God. I don't care how much your family loves you. I don't care how much anything else is happening. If you have not stopped the life of a rebel and said there is a Redeemer and he is my peace, then all you have are a few symbolic things in your life. But if you have Christ as your peace, what in the world can the world ever do to you? What can it ever do to you? Literally, the peace of God that passes all understanding begins because I'm no longer at war with God. Christmas is not so much about the birth of Christ as it is Christmas begins with the birth of the one who would bring me peace. Now, if you were thinking about it for a second, you would say, well, if he came to bring me peace, maybe he's done a partial job, but he hadn't done a very full job. I'm losing an aunt to cancer. We lost a job. Boy, my wife and I aren't getting along well. I don't think he really brought peace. Expectations change everything. What are your expectations? I mean, do you have realistic expectations? If I were to set a meal out before you, and I put this meal on a table, and I meet you outside the door, and I say to you, you are about to have one of the finest meals. I mean, there's no chef greater in this land than the one who made this meal. Come into the greatest chef's meal, and you come in, and I guarantee you, you start at that, you would go, wow, that's nice, but I don't know that that blows me out of the water. Gee whiz. Kind of disappointed, I guess. I expected more. If, on the other hand, I set the exact same meal out in front of you, and I met you on the other side of the door, and I said, you're about to go in and have the first meal made by my first great granddaughter and a meal made by my second great granddaughter. They worked together and made that meal. You would come in and go, this is, wow, I'm pretty impressed. That's pretty good. What made the difference in the food? Your expectation. The reason many individuals struggle with God in this world is you have the wrong expectation. Here's the second twist in this text. You need to know that your war with God is the first big rock in all of life, but here's the truth. If you ever make yourself a friend of God, everybody who's God's enemy turns on you. That's just the reality. He says that very plainly in Scripture, that when you become my friend, the way they hated me, they're going to hate you. And you're going to live at war. Now you're at war with a different kind of enemy. At first, you were at war with an enemy who loved you and was pursuing you and wooing you and wanted you and wept over you. Now you have an enemy that hates you, an enemy that's... Go finish this out. Now, if we summarize this down, so where does that enemy come from? It comes from three things. We find that in the New Testament, but it comes from the world, the flesh, and the devil. There are three things waging war on you as a believer. Now then, on the first part of this prince of peace, if I can borrow that from Isaiah and put it here in Micah, this prince of Bethlehem, he gives you peace with God. On this second war, this massive war around you, now he gives you the peace of God. A peace of God that is wrapped around you because the world, the flesh, and the devil are going to wage war on you. And you live in a war-torn land. How could you not expect that? Jesus says that in this world you will have troubles, but be of good cheer. I've overcome the world. And let me take those down just for a second. The first one is the world is going to wage war against you. The world is not a particular magazine or a particular theory. It's not a particular lifestyle. Ultimately, the world is an attitude that says now. The very word secular means now. It takes all of life and rips it away from the purposes that God made it and says now. And so the world is constantly going now, now, now. That's the reason some of you sleep with your boyfriends and your girlfriends, because you're secular. Oh, you said I have the peace of Christ, but no, you don't. You have been taken captive by the world. Your mind's taken captive because you live in the now. Now is what it amounts to. And so the now always corrupts anything, any good gift God gives you. Any good gift is corrupted by the now, and the world will wage war against you. And so you're going to see that. You watch 20,000 gazillion billion commercials. You say they don't affect me. That's not true. That's not true. They really do. They really do affect you. You may not realize it. They're subversive. Even here, Micah calls them seductive. Seductive. And so you begin to look at yourself through eyes of, wow, I'm not everything I wished I were, and I'm not everything that's highly respected in the eyes of the now people. And you begin to look at everything that you've accomplished, and you wonder whether you failed, and you begin to look at all the hopes and dreams, and the world just seduces your heart. Man, what do I need? With a world that wages war against you, let me take you a passage that talks about the peace of Christ. Verse 4 of Philippians chapter 4. It's a classic passage. When it introduces the Prince of Peace idea, this is part of what it's talking about. Peace with God and peace from God. Notice Paul's attitude. He's in prison. He's not that far away from being executed. The world is at war with him. The world thinks he's stupid. The world's mocking him. The world is, man, he ought to be downcast and disturbed, right? Nah. Why? Because the peace of God is pretty incredible. Let's read through it. Verse 4. Rejoice in the Lord always. I'll say it again, rejoice. Well, how in the world can you do that? Won't we have sorrows and brokenheartedness and be burying our friends? And yeah, we will. But there's a deeper truth. A deeper truth, even in the middle of all my sorrow, I will rejoice. Why? Well, verse 5, the Lord is near, for one thing. Verse 6, don't be anxious about anything, but in every situation, by prayer and petition, with thanksgiving, present your requests to God, and the peace of God, which transcends all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus. So while the world looks at you, if you're an eighth grade boy, I promise you, it is a tough way to grow up. Man, go to a locker room and be an eighth grade boy. You think about picking and devouring one another and cannibalism. It occurs. Try being a sophomore in high school girl, cannibalism occurs. Try being somebody low on the totem pole and work and see how cannibalism works. Man, life is constantly this sense of a world that's broken. But what if I thought, and what if I was thankful, and what if I understood the peace of God is meant to guard me? The only thing I have to do is get the peace of God. I've spoken up in Oregon at a marriage conference a couple of times. One of them, I was out at the wilds on the beach The ocean hitting that part was incredible. I mean, just take your breath away watching how violent the ocean looks. And you would see this rock and this huge, massive set of waves would just pound the soup out of it. I guess there actually is the right word. Pound the soup out of it. You think, man, that rock can't be there when that wave leaves. And that wave would go back, and there that rock stands unshakable. That same illustration is this. Not only will I make you have peace with God, but I will be your peace. The world will give you 1,000, 10,000 paper cuts, but it cannot change the substance. I am your God, and you are my child. And whatever waves hit you, I promise you I will turn everything to your good. And I promise you, nothing shall separate us. Peace is not, as Oswald Sanders has said, peace is not the absence of conflict. Peace is the presence and the character of God. You have it. That's why Paul could sing hymns in a prison cell. Because the peace of God covers me. That peace of God is absolutely critical. If you do not have this one from Bethlehem who brought you peace, man, your mind is just flying apart all the time. And you're so stinking inconsistent, depending upon your moods. The peace of Christ guarding you. There's a second thing that will wage war upon you. It's not just the world. Every now and then there's a group who goes, man, we're going to bunker ourselves away from the world so they can't bother us. Well, good news, you know, that won't work. Here's why. You bunkered yourself with one of your worst enemies, your flesh. your flesh. There's a part of you, each of us, that wants to be God. And my flesh is the part of me that wants to be God. And there's a portion of it. You can see that flesh. That flesh basically says this: I want to have the blessings, but I'm not that interested in the blesser. I want to have the benefits. I want to have the luxury, but I don't necessarily want the giver. C.S. Lewis one time talked about how the sun rays always lead your eye back to the sun. But it isn't a weird thing in life that all the blessings don't automatically lead you back to the blesser. My flesh likes the blessings. There's a part of my flesh doesn't always want to meet and put it in context of the blesser. Because if it did, then every good thing I had would cause me to worship. And everything that occurred would cause me to turn my eye back to him. But in the flesh, the part of me that wants to be God says, I refuse to look at the blesser. So therefore, food, even though it's a gift from God, becomes my act of gluttony. I can't even handle the blessing because I lost context with the blesser. And that's why money becomes ultimately corrupting to me. Because the good thing I was given, it didn't turn my eye to the blesser. My flesh is always going to struggle with that. You say, well, I'm so glad that I became a Christian and don't have a problem anymore. Well, I'm glad you became a Christ follower. It took away the guilt of your sin. But no, it didn't stop the war between you and your flesh. Beforehand, he was a guy that womanized because he wanted to feel dominant and virile, and he wanted to be respected in the eyes of the big boys in the pool hall or whatever it was. And before, he wanted to be the center of attention, and he wanted to be dominant. And now he became a Christian, and now then in board meetings, he talks too much. And now in classes and in his family, he's too dominant. And when decisions are made, he wants to be the one who calls the shots. You can make your flesh very religious. And so many of us have just religious flesh. The Prince of Peace comes along and says, wow, man, you got a war going on inside of you. Won't you let the peace of Christ cover you? Romans chapter 8, the peace of Christ, the Spirit of God, will help you put to death the thing that's warring on you. Man, you have an ally. Let the peace of Christ be your ally. The last one's the devil. The devil is interesting. We tend to think of the devil as temptation. I'm an old codger, and so Flip Wilson was around in the olden days. And his excuse for everything he did was, the devil made me do it. Well, truth is, the Bible clearly says there are hostile beings on the other side of the veil you can't see. But it's interesting, the Bible doesn't so much tie the devil into temptation as he does accusation. That's the number one thing. I mean, if you just go through and look at it, accusation is the number one thing. Meaning what? The voice of the devil is, you're not good enough. You failed. Give in. You're lousy. Remember what you did? And you call yourself a Christian. The accuser. The very word, Satan, is from the old word that means prosecutor. So here's what you have. You go to bed at night, and at 4 o'clock in the morning, you wake up, and there he stands. All your failures right there. All your stupidness, and we all have it. By the way, he's not entirely wrong. Every lie has a grain of truth to it. So he takes a grain of truth about stupid things you've done, and he lays them out, and the accuser is there. And man, you're going to need the peace of Christ. Because if the peace of Christ does not come around you, you don't have any answer. And so I go back to Bethlehem, and I find the one who said, let me make peace with God for you, and let me make peace with everything else. Let me give you a place of peace for everything else that wars on you, the world, your flesh, the devil. His name is Horatio Safford. Horatio Safford was a lawyer in Chicago in the 1870s. Horatio Stafford did suffer loss in the Chicago fire. He was a Christian, a believer. His family had gone through quite a bit of stress, he thought, from the fire and other things, and he put his family on a steamer and sent them to England, his wife and his four daughters. But in the Atlantic, there was a ship collision. And the ship that his wife, Anna, and his four daughters were on was hit by another one, and in 12 minutes, the ship they were on sunk. Obviously, the mom tried to save them, but the four daughters drowned. Anna was found unconscious and floating on her back in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean by the ship that had rammed them. They pulled her in. They went ahead and went on to England. She cabled back to Horatio, and she cabled back some of the hardest words you can ever imagine. She cabled back, "Saved alone. What shall I do?" Horatio got on a ship himself, immediately headed to England. They got to the latitude and longitude where the accident had occurred. The ship's captain said, "I don't know if you want to know or not, but this is the spot." And they said he stood alongside the rail and watched the rough ocean. And he stood as they passed that spot. He went down to his bunk, and he stayed up that night. And here's what he did. He wrote this set of words. "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well with my soul." Now let me stop here for a second. That's not a band-aid on an artery. What it means is the world of the now is not going to win. I refuse to see this through just the now. Oh, I have sorrows. They're like those sea billows. But the now does not win. He's going to take this further. He's even going to say the accuser is not going to win. What words would you write about the death of your children? Well, one of the first things you would think about is God punishing me. Am I being punished? Did I do something wrong? Is God's retribution on me? I want you to notice the next set of words that will follow through this. Though Satan should buffet, though trials should come, let this blessed assurance control that Christ had regarded my helpless estate, and he hath shed his own blood for my soul. This is not me. He took my punishment. I'm not being punished here. He took my punishment. The accuser has no voice.